I would definitely put it in the top 10.
It's so good.
A lot more thought has gone into the story.
I think it's awesome.
This is a spy movie disguised as a superhero movie.
There's such clear-cut good and bad.
It's definitely got some horrific elements.
Well, once we go there, you're just going to throw physics out the window.
That's not how this works. That's not how any of this works.
This is like the Fast Times at Ridgemont High of the fantasy world. Yep. Wow. That was something else. Now, kids, your homework tonight is to go home and watch this on television.
At that point in the script, you're actually rooting for her.
And I am just giggling maniacally through the whole thing.
When slashers came home.
I love that they just throw you in there and say, okay, find your way out. A lot of people don't like horror movies.
It's a coming of age, not a horror movie.
But I still love it because it's a slice of life, and I'm okay with that. Tim really wants to like this movie.
I loved the production design.
I wanted more from this movie.
Your reality is not what you think it is.
Oh my God, am I destroying our podcast?
You are listening to the sound of a completely new screen experience. A startling new kind of excitement. As 20th Century Fox plunges you into the most incredible adventure that man could ever achieve. To make a motion picture that crosses a new frontier may seem impossible today. Outer space, the depths of the sea, the bowels of the earth, the past, the future. All have been subjects for the camera. But now, a film called Fantastic Voyage has broken through in an unexpected direction to create an adventure of astonishing suspense and beauty.
One of the miracles of the universe.
Its vital news story sweeps down from the sky. Then, it drops the bottom out of the world you know and understand. As a beleaguered nation, desperate for survival, launches a journey you can never erase from your memory.
We need you for security purposes, Mr. Grant. They know they failed to kill Benish. Security thinks they'll try again, first chance they get.
A woman has no place on a mission of this kind.
I insist on taking my technician.
You'll take along who I assign.
Don't tell me who I'm going to work with.
Four men and a beautiful girl, off on a fantastic voyage, actually entering inside the human body, exploring an unknown universe, unknown dangers.
They're tightening. I can't breathe.
24 seconds left.
After that, you're in danger of attack.
Come on, Doctor.
It's sheer suicide for all of us.
You are there with them, sharing a breakthrough in motion pictures.
He's gone.
If you thought it was too late to discover something entirely new on the screen, Fantastic Voyage will be a stunning experience. For you are going where no man or camera has ventured before.
Hello, 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 out there in YouTube and podcast land. You have reached Johnny Has the Keys, where we talk about horror movies and science fiction films and those key elements that often lift and sometimes separate them from the average genre fare. Sometimes, well, actually, they're always separated, but not always good, sometimes bad, but always memorable. I am here with my co-host, David. We would like to welcome you if you're joining us for the first time. David and I have known each other for a very long time, and we've talked movies our entire lives. And we got together a few years ago and said, you know what, let's tackle this by all movies. Let's see if we can do a few from each decade every season and dive into what made them work and what possibly influenced other films, et cetera, et cetera. And we are doing it for the masses. We did a couple of seasons of podcasts. Then we delved over into YouTube. And now we have a YouTube show as well. And, well, those of you coming back, you already know this. And that's why you're here. And we're glad you're here. I'm here with my co-host. Can I say here one more time, please? Here.
Yeah, here. Please here.
David, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. I'm doing good. I'm just getting over a cold, but that's okay. And hopefully I won't hack or cough or do anything like that to disturb anyone. But I'm glad to be back and doing the podcasts and all that fun stuff. And we normally start out with a little icebreaker of what have we done in our genre week, meaning genre related for the past week, specifically me in science fiction and you in horror. And I have been continuing my reading assault, i.e. audiobook assault, for those of you who delineate reading from listening, I guess, and got interested in a new science fiction one that had come out. It actually has been out for about 10 years now, and it's called Dark Matter. Have you ever heard that title, or have you seen it in conjunction with like a television series?
It seems like I have.
So I kind of got interested in it because the title kept popping up in my recommends and all that. And I thought, I don't know this author. The author is Blake Crouch.
Yeah, I know who he is.
Oh, okay.
He did Wayward Pines.
Oh, okay. I did not know that because I didn't research him, but I didn't know the author. But the title kept coming up and in a lot of people's recommends and everything.
He also did something else we know, Something at the End of the World. It may be the one that Shyamalan did with Baptista.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. His book was called something else, and Shyamalan changed the title, but he did that as well.
I did not know that. Mm-hmm. I did know that he's from North Carolina, which is interesting. He's from Chapel Hill, so I thought that was anyway.
We've got a friend over there.
Yeah. So Dark Matter, and it's a thriller. So it's a very Michael Crichton kind of feel to it, but it involves just as a teaser for you, in case you might want to read it or be interested in it, this guy, he's a quantum physicist, like all good heroes and stories are. Anyway, he's a college professor sort of thing, and he lives in Chicago with his wife and his son. And he's coming home from the office one day, and he decides to take just a different way because he wants to take a little bit longer to get back to the family. Even though he's all happy, they're just kind of in that kind of sedentary part of the relationship where he goes to work, does his thing, she stays home, takes care of the kid, yada, yada, that's it. Anyway, stops by a bodega and everything else, and he's going, and all of a sudden, a person runs up to him, puts a gun in his back, takes him to a car, drives him to this very obscure, way-off place outside of suburbs of Chicago, forces him down into this like warehouse sort of thing, makes him take off all his clothes, drugs him, and then a few hours, he guesses, later, he wakes up in different clothes and staggers out of the warehouse and goes to find his house, and nobody recognizes him, knows him, and everything else. And he's in a totally alternate universe.
Oh.
And the rest of the story goes from there. That's like the first chapter, and you go, holy crap.
Right. He does write trippy stuff like that.
Yeah. So it's all about this pursuit of, if there are multiple dimensions or a multiverse, how do you get back to your original one if you've been kidnapped and thrown into a different one? And it's really good. It's very intriguing. It was so good, ironically, before even I read it, that they turned it into a television series. And it's got a 9-episode series.
That's what I know.
Yeah. Okay. And Joel Edgerton.
I like him. Yeah.
Yeah. He's the lead in it. I ended up watching it as well just to see. I love translations and adaptations. We both do. And see how well they did. And they did a really, really good job.
Okay.
With adapting. So if you like Dark Matter, the novel, Dark Matter, the television series is good and is a great adaptation. Yeah.
I'm going to make a correction before I go on. It is not Blake Crouch that did the Knock at the Cabin story. It's a guy named Paul Tremblay, who I do kind of confuse with Blake Crouch. Paul did A Head Full of Ghost, which has been in development for a very long time. It was a critically acclaimed horror novel.
Okay.
So I did not mean to do that. So you people out there yelling at me, I have corrected it.
Well, I did, because I read it. I did get a tag on one of his other novels, which was called Upgrade, which is about genetic engineering. So, yeah, this guy seems like he's a new Michael Crichton.
Yeah, I was not that crazy about the Wayward Pines adaptation. It had one of the, oh, man, who's the guy from The Blob that has a brother? They're both actors and have been since the 80s.
Ethan Hawke?
No. I hate that my memory is
Well, that was Shyamalan, right?
No, I'm talking about...
Wayward Pines is Shyamalan. So, Matt Damon. Yeah.
No.
No, Matt Dillon.
Matt Dillon. That's it. I couldn't. And Kevin Dillon's his brother. Anyway, yeah, I just remember I did not like that adaptation that much. So I'm not. I don't think I ever read the book though. So I'm not sure how well it was done.
Okay.
All right. Well, anyway, enough.
Enough
for,
of this.
For you folks tuning
reality.
In for the first time, David and I tend to digress a lot.
We do.
But I want to talk about something that I'm pretty hyped about that I happen to catch in my genre week, and that is a little movie called Queens of the Dead.
Okay. Okay.
What is the first thing that comes to your mind when I say that title, Queens of the Dead?
I would think it is a zombie story with drag queens.
Okay, very, very good.
Is it really? Seriously? Yes. Oh, my God.
But believe it or not, it's good. It's an awesome discovery, as a matter of fact. Yes, it is a zombie film, and yes, it is a comedy. And you know that I'm not big on horror comedies.
Right.
And we already know that you can't top Shaun of the Dead. So a zombie horror comedy has to be pretty decent for me to enjoy it. And I enjoyed this movie immensely.
Great.
Yeah, it's got some silly moments. But like I said, it is a comedy. It has many things I love, namely zombies and drag queens. And the thing that really, really lifts this one above the average is it is directed by Tina Romero, George Romero's daughter.
Really?
Yes. I don't know if she's gay or not. She gives me, when I see a picture of her, I'm like, oh, she could be family, but I'm not sure. It is written by Aaron Judge, who I'm pretty sure is gay, and she is a comedian. So it was written by a comedian in conjunction with Tina Romero, who is essentially the daughter of the man that created the entire thing we know as the zombie universe.
Okay.
The cast is fantastic. I cannot name them all, so I'm just going to name the familiar faces. Sorry to some of those people that are new and the leads. But Nina West plays the main drag queen in this. She is one of Dennis and mine's favorite from RuPaul's Drag Race competition. She is a comedic drag queen. She does comedy. That's her specialty. There's a guy in there named Quincy Dunn Baker. He is the token straight guy. Really the only straight guy in this. And he's great. He is very, very funny. It has Dominique Jackson, the trans actress from the show Pose with Billy Porter that won all kinds of Emmys. She is in it. Margaret Cho is in this movie. She plays sort of a badass zombie killer in it, which is perfect for her.
Perfect.
Cheyenne Jackson is in it. He is a very familiar face stage actor that crossed over into television and movies. You would remember him from 30 Rock, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
He also was the lead in that 9/11 movie about the plane that went down and crashed not into anything. He played the
in
gate.
Pennsylvania.
Yeah, flight, whatever the number is. I can't remember. Yeah. He plays the hero in that. So if you don't know who Cheyenne Jackson is, he's really good. And I'm just going to stop there because it's an ensemble. So none of these people are leads. It's a great group cast. The film synopsis is it follows a group of drag queens, club kids, and frenemies who must put aside their personal dramas and use their unique skills to fight flesh thirsty undead when a zombie apocalypse breaks out on the night of a giant warehouse party.
Well, okay then.
It gets 87% on Rotten Tomatoes with 52 reviews. I'm totally cool with that. It is silly, like I said, sometimes, but Tina is clearly her father's daughter. And you will see a lot of George Romero in this film.
Oh, that's cool.
And if the cast isn't enough, it also features cameos from Galen Ross and Tom Savini. Yeah.
Dang. Okay.
So I caught this on Shudder, and I highly recommend it. I was thrilled when I found out about
it. Dad, thanks for the zombies. So, yeah, that's interesting because I've been reading recently a lot about King's Son because he's getting really popular still.
Joe?
And still, yeah. Oh,
yeah.
And still increasing. And I think I still have not watched Nosferatu, whatever, the one with the license plate.
I saw like the first season of it.
Okay. I need to do that and watch it. But it's interesting, these kids of famous horror auteurs are carrying on the legacy sort of thing.
Yeah. Wouldn't it be great if like Tina directed a movie written by Joe Hill? That would be awesome.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That might work.
Yeah.
More zombie-ish.
But she doesn't have many credits, and some of them are her dad's stuff where she was like a kid in his movie, like as an actress. Mm-hmm. She was in Land of the Dead, for one. But I'm like, she needs to keep this up. She's really good. This comedian partner she did the movie with that helped write it, she's good too. I was very happy with this. I wish they would have gotten Simon Pegg to make an appearance in it too.
Oh, that would have been classic.
Yeah.
Literally. So, yeah. Well, not a good segue from that because I did a trans-dimensional science fiction story and Tim did a gay zombie movie. So, yeah. But, okay, that aside, there's not really a way to segue into our Redux this week. We are actually, for those of you who are new to us, as Tim said in the opening, we did the first 2 years of our podcast were podcast only, and we had some technical difficulties at times, and we were still experimenting and learning the whole craft of podcasting, so to speak. And then Tim persuaded us to do a YouTube channel. So now we are slowly, season by season, reduxing or rebooting episodes that we originally did and doing them in this YouTube format and also re-recording them for the podcast. So it's that sort of thing. So we have done this movie before, but we're now doing it again. And usually in these reduxes, I don't know about you. I can't remember for you, Tim, but normally I don't go back to the original episode and listen to it. So I view it just like we're doing it for the regular podcast. So watch the film, take the notes, do the thing, just like we normally do. But that being said, for those of you science fiction fans out there, we are going back to 1966. Star Trek had not even premiered yet on network television.
Wow.
And a film called Fantastic Voyage. It came out in 66. It was written by Harry Kleiner, David Duncan, and Otto Clement. It was directed by Richard Fleischer, who was a fairly good director at the time. Starred Stephen Boyd, Raquel Welch, Edmund O'Brien, among others. And I adore this movie. I'm not sure how, I can't remember how you feel about it. Tim, when's the first time you saw this movie?
If I am not mistaken, I think the first time I saw this movie was the first time we did it. I was tempted to go back and find it and listen just to determine that, because I don't remember ever seeing this movie other than us covering it before.
Wow. Okay.
And I like it. I think I like it better maybe even the second viewing, so.
Excellent. I saw it in high school. I remember seeing it probably on television because I think ABC did show it every other year or something like that. I remember it had ABC credit because I remember I loved that poster, the one you have behind you. I loved it all in red with just the yellow Fantastic and the eye. Mm-hmm. Although that is one of the big complaints people have about this movie is the ending.
It's
sort of thing.
Spoiler. Yeah.
Yeah, but I seem to somehow associate that with the ABC logo. So I think I saw it on ABC originally. Then I owned the VHS, of course, and have watched it a dozen times since then. I really have always liked this movie. It also has, to me, it would make a great double feature with Andromeda Strain because I think it feels the same as that movie. Trying to be technologically advanced with whatever right now, which is with like flip clocks and and still right. coffee burners on your computer consoles and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. And this is 5 years before Andromeda Strain, too.
Yeah. Yeah. So for, I guess, a synopsis is somewhat in order. For those of you who haven't seen it, do please go watch the movie now, because we do give spoilers, of course. And this movie is, like we said, 50 years old. So you should have seen it at least by now. But if not, go watch it and then come back to us. But basically, we start out like we're in a spy thriller. We have a covert thing at night with someone getting off a plane and then being transported. His convoy is attacked and he is hospitalized. A CIA agent named Grant, who played by Stephen Boyd, is requested to appear at this covert government organization that he's never heard of before, called the IMF. And he goes down and finds out that the person being transported was actually a Russian defector, although they never say Russian. They say the other side, or them, or they. But is a defector scientist who has developed this special miniaturization process. They have replicated it in the United States, and they have it, but the drawback is it only miniaturizes something for an hour. So whether they miniaturize a briefcase or a car or, God forbid, a person or a submarine, they can only stay that way for an hour. Anyway, this scientist has a hemorrhage in his brain. He is going to die from it and or be in a coma for the rest of his life. They need the knowledge in his head because he knows how to keep the miniaturization process for longer than an hour. So they need him alive. The only way they see to do that, because it's an inoperable brain tumor or blood clot, is to take a submarine, a CIA agent, a bunch of scientists, miniaturize that to the size of a cell, inject it, and have them go to his brain and laser out this blood clot. And thus the fantastic voyage begins. Scenes? Are there scenes you remember from this?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. First and foremost is probably the antibody scene.
Oh, God, where, yeah.
Where they are attacked by various antibodies and they cling all over Raquel Welch. And then I think the thing I remember most about it is when they get her inside and they're trying to remove them, that they crystallize. I thought that was strange. They crystallize.
Yes. Yeah.
And then the other scene, of course, Donald Pleasance is in this movie, and I could watch him do anything. And he's usually a nefarious type, and he is in this, and he bites it at the end because he gets devoured by a white corpuscle. And that's pretty memorable to me as well.
I always remembered that. I always remembered the white corpuscle enveloping him and him screaming and everything. Mm-hmm. It was very The Blob. Yep. Kind of. As a matter of fact, that's one of the keys I have from it for that scene.
Right.
I also, to me, I loved the whole, the first time they go into the bloodstream. And to me, it's kind of a good segue to production and production notes and everything, because the reason it's so memorable to me is, A, the visual that happens immediately when they're suddenly, because they've been floating in just like a saline water thing, and now they're floating in the bloodstream, and we see the inside of the human body for the first time, sort of thing. But the music there is just so interesting and dynamic. And that's because, and for those of you who have watched it, that doesn't happen for like 30 minutes into the movie. It takes a while before we get into the human body, sort of thing. And before that, there is no real soundtrack. There's no music in the movie. And that was an intentional thing by the composer. He wanted only sound effects and some weird kind of cacophony percussion stuff and all that until they entered the body, and then there would be full-scale music. I thought that was a really cool idea.
Yeah.
That was a direct recommendation from the composer, to only have the music go full-blown orchestral kind of sound once they enter the body.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a ton of sound effects in this movie all the way through it. And all of those were created specifically for this film and were used for like decades after it, especially in the 60s and 70s. You can recognize so many of these sound effects in $6 Million Man and Star Trek and Planet of the Apes and so many other movies where they repurposed these sound effects that, and I think I've got his name, that were created in this. They were actually called Hickey effects because Ralph Hickey was the big sound guy at Fox, and he developed all these sound effects. And so they started naming them after him, and they were reused forever. Mm-hmm. At the time, this was the most expensive science fiction film ever made. And they, 20th Century Fox, dumped tons of money into this production. And it really showed. It ended up getting them an Oscar, which was crazy for a special effects film like this sort of thing. But also, so the budget was originally $3 million, but they ended up spending $6 million, over $1 million. And this is in 1966. You're spending $6 million. If you think about it, Star Wars, a decade later, cost only $9 million. And that was Star Wars. So,
well, Cleopatra was in 1963, and that was like the most expensive movie to date.
Ever.
And I want to say that was just $1 million, wasn't it?
I think it was $2 million.
Okay, because it was one of those where it was like everyone was freaked out about how much it cost to make that movie at the time.
Yeah. So the budget finally ended up being around $6 million, but $1 million of that was just in testing. They spent over a year just in testing effects because, for those of you out there who are younger, there are no computers in this. This is no CGI. This is no, even multicam passes had not been invented yet. The digital cameras had not been invented yet. All of this had to be done with practical photography effects of the time in the 60s. So,
and there's no water photography either.
Correct.
They're faking all of that.
All of that is wire work, and all of that is done on dry, what they call dry sets.
It blows my mind because it looks like they're swimming. It really does.
Yes. The only thing that really gives it away to me is like when they're pulling the things out of the vents, they all fall down. When they're pulling them out, they all fall down.
Instead of floating, yeah.
Yeah. Gotcha. But experimenting with different speeds of the camera so that it looks like they're floating and in water and everything else. Experimenting with different practicals, because all of these sets, again, this isn't blue screen or green screen or any of that computer digital. They built these huge, ginormous sets with like running lights in them for brain neurons and all this kind of stuff. It's really, really incredible effects. And the effects I wanted to mention were done, well, Richard Edlund, who we've mentioned several times, especially in the 50s and 60s, a big special effects artist, he called this the photochemical era. And they did some ultra processing on the actual film, so that the color shifts would be right and the colors would look really dynamic. That's why the whites in this look really, really white. And all the colors look really, but they don't look technicolor, but they look really vibrant. Does that make sense?
Well, I don't know that they don't look technicolor, but they definitely are vibrant.
Well, if you think technicolor, like the one I always mention, everybody's White Christmas. Everybody remembers White Christmas as color because the reds are red and the blues are blue. Sort of thing. But Richard Edlund was the special effects supervisor for this. Also, a guy named Bill Abbott did it. And then another one I wanted to mention was they were looking for someone who could come up with an idea of, okay, then how do we film the human body? How do we film blood vessels and stuff like that? And Disney's best friend, co-partner, the guy that there would not be a Disney without him, was Ub Iwerks, which I'm sure you know. And Ub was his big genius that helped him. He really was the one who animated Mickey Mouse, even though Disney created the original sketches. But so Ub was his partner forever. He recommended a guy that they had at Disney called Art Kershank. Art ended up coming up with all of the idea of using essentially lava lamps to create all of the floating gelatinous sort of cells and stuff that they use. Some of the forced perspective that they use, a couple of the angles. Anyway, he ended up being so good that he won an Oscar for this movie, he himself. So, yeah.
Well, and Richard Fleischer had ties to Disney already because he did 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. So I'm sure he knew some of these guys as well, probably.
And Fleischer had a medical degree or medical history I think, wow. from what I remember. So he could, when they were going through the testing process and when they were going through the original creation of the ideas and everything, he could say, this is what we need to do. And this is a pulmonary embolism or that kind of stuff.
Do you think he's obsessed with submarines or this is just a coincidence?
Same designer. The designer of the Proteus, which, by the way, I love. I had a model of this that got destroyed like the first year I built it, and I could never find another one, and I wanted one so bad. But I love the Proteus design. It's really cool. It's really neat. But it was designed by the same guy who designed the Nautilus for 20,000 Leagues.
All right, folks, if you know where one is out there, you need
please
to
tell me.
Let David know.
I would love a Proteus. And they built it again. Back to the cost of the production, they built it practically. They built a full-scale mock-up, and that made it so believable to have scenes like when they first get into the submarine. And because it was a full-scale model, or full-scale set submarine, they could shoot both inside and outside. Mm-hmm. So they could shoot inside the sub, and you could see things in the windows and outside and everything else. They could also shoot outside and show them in the sub.
Yeah.
Sort of thing, which was really cool and really neat. But yeah, I think he may have loved submarines, as he should. Submarines are good things. So yes.
Before we move on to Cass, did you mention Isaac Asimov's connection to this movie? I don't think you did.
I did not, but you can, and then I want to comment on it.
Well, yeah. Isaac actually wrote the novelization of the film, which confuses a lot of people because they think it was actually a novel and the film was based on the novel, but it's actually the opposite.
Yep. So. What happened was they gave him the screenplay and said, we need you to do the novel. We're going to put it out at the same time as the movie and everything else. However, it took them so long with this special effects testing and special effects work and rework and everything else that the novel came out before the movie.
Okay.
And so people thought that it was based on the novel that had just been released a couple of months earlier.
Isaac Asimov.
Correct.
And I heard he corrected a lot of stuff in it, too.
I actually went back and listened to the audiobook of this to see. And yes, he had some big issues with what they did in the movie and went back later and corrected them in the reprints of the novel. But specifically, the ones that people have mentioned without giving spoilers. Okay, yeah, spoilers.
50-year-old spoilers.
Yeah. The very, the very end of the movie has... the Donald Pleasance character, like we said, eaten by a white corpus, a white blood cell, and also the submarine itself.
Yeah.
But they like leave the laser gun, they leave the submarine, they go away. Even now, watching it for like the dozenth time, I still think, oh, well, white blood cells ate everything and absorbed everything. And that made sense to me. But supposedly, Isaac Asimov got really upset. Other people did that. When they increased in size, so would all the wreckage and everything of the submarine.
Yeah,
so basically, Benish's head would explode because the submarine would come out of it.
Right. Now that's the movie I want to see.
I was just about to say. Now that's the reboot that you would watch. The other one that came out of so there were four big things that came out of Asimov talking about this screenplay. One was the submarine size at the end and not getting the submarine out. So in his novelization, the sub actually comes out too on the slide with them. They actually force the corpuscle to kind of chase them and it follows them out of the eye so that everything makes sense. However, that doesn't make up for the syringe and the fluid that they inject into this because we now know from biochemistry and everything else that if they shrunk the fluid that they were in the hypodermic needle and injected in the body, unless that was totally absorbed in time, the molecules in that, in the syringe, in the liquid, would also expand. So you would have, he would explode because.
I hadn't really thought about that. Okay.
The illogic of the actual mission itself, if it's so easy to get to the blood clot from the eye, then why didn't they inject them into the eye?
to begin
with. That's true.
And they just zip over and go.
Or in the nose. And
so that was it. So yeah, those were the big issues with it that Asimov sort of fixed in the reprint. So it kind of worked.
Okay. Well, I can move on to cast.
Sure.
Excuse me. First of all, we have Stephen Boyd, who plays Grant. He's kind of the lead, you would say. His most famous role is that of Messala in the classic movie Ben-Hur, opposite Charlton Heston.
Yep.
I do have a little trivia note on him, though. He was the original choice to play James Bond in Dr. No.
Yep.
I'm not sure what happened there.
I don't know what happened to him in general. Boyd seemed to have, I don't know if it was an attitude issue, if there was a something, but like his career never went where it should have. I think he was really good.
Didn't we speculate on this last time?
I think we did the last time.
That he may have been gay and closeted. Raquel had a crush on him, and it didn't go anywhere. I remember us talking about that. But I don't really remember looking him up. I think he was maybe briefly married. Oh, well, I'm not going to delve into it.
But he basically had roles, but nothing large and nothing like this. And according to IMDb, he's gotten nothing after 77.
He was also good friends with Brigitte Bardot, who recently died, which is really, how many hot men would just be friends with Brigitte Bardot?
Well, everyone that could. No.
Yeah, that kind of makes my gaydar ping a little bit. But anyway, I'm not going to go into that this time because most of it's going to be speculation.
You know how we had those two or three guys when we go in the 50s movies, like the guy from War of the Worlds, and they're so heroic men and good and everything else. And you would think, oh, they probably had huge careers, and they didn't.
And then if you start doing a little snooping, you can find out some history as far as orientation. Yeah. For another classic example is Tom Tryon. He was gay, though. He came out, but he was doing leads in sci-fi movies in the 50s as well.
Yeah. And I noticed a lot of the credits here for Boyd are European. So I don't know if he gave up on Hollywood and maybe went to Europe.
And maybe that's how I knew Brigitte Bardot, though.
Yep. Too. That would make sense.
Secondly, we have Raquel Welch as Cora Peterson. She had another big movie this year. This was like her breakout year. She did 1 million BC in this year.
Oh,
or
yeah.
1 million years BC. I get them confused because one of them's a remake of another one, and I never can remember the title of which.
Yep.
But they're both movies with dinosaurs. So there you go.
Yes, they are.
Cavemen and dinosaurs.
And fur bikinis. Yes.
She was also in Three Musketeers, as well as Myra Breckinridge, which was also written by Gore Vidal, another gay person. I don't have much else to say about her.
She gets a lot of flack sometimes, but I thought she did a great job in this movie.
Oh, I've always liked her. I think last time you brought up another movie she was in that I've never seen, something about roller derby.
Oh, Bay City Rollers. No. What was it? It was Roller.
That's a pop band from the late 70s.
It was. They did Saturday Night. Saturday Night.
It's not Rollerball. It's something.
I remember seeing it. I have to look it up.
Anyway.
Kansas City Bomber.
There you go. So she was also in a roller derby movie in the 70s. It was like a cult movie, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, but one of my favorites, and not a lot of people know it, is a movie called Hanny Calder. And she plays a woman. It's a Western. And she, of course, is abused it's a whole vengeance movie. But basically, she wears boots, a poncho, and a gun belt. That's all she wears in the entire movie. So it's her. It's like a version of Clint Eastwood's Silent Guy as a female vengeful person.
Okay.
So
the dude.
Hanny Calder. It was good. Hmm. Yeah.
Next, we have Edmund O'Brien, who played General Carter. I don't have anything on him except that he played Peabody in The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. And the only reason I put that down is because I love that movie. That's one of my favorite John Wayne, Jimmy Stewart movies.
Well, and he was a staple in Westerns and a staple in television in the
60s. Maybe even John Ford movies.
Yeah, you see him in... That wouldn't surprise me. You see him in everything in the 60s. He did a bunch of... all the Westerns. So he did The Virginian, he did Gunsmoke, all of that. Mm-hmm. So...
Next up, we have Donald Pleasance as Dr. Michaels. We do learn, spoiler, 60-year-old spoiler, that he is a spy, basically, that's going to thwart the mission of saving this doctor.
I thought it was well done, though, too, because he is such an eccentric character all the way through it. I remember even watching it early on, the first few times I watched it, that I wouldn't suspect him. I would have suspected the scientist and or the pilot, but I would never suspect the scientist. And he turns out, because he's mousy and scared all the time and all this. Mm-hmm. And he turns out to be the double agent.
Yeah, and he conks that guy on the head. I was like, damn.
Yeah.
We know him from the horror world and the science fiction world, actually. He played Dr. Loomis, of course, in Halloween. That's probably his most famous role. But he was also the president in Escape from New York. Another John Carpenter movie. We saw him a few seasons back in Prince of Darkness, where he was a priest. He played Dr. Leo Bain in Alone in the Dark, another movie that we've covered on this podcast, as well as this. Actually, his most famous role may be Blofeld in You Only Live Twice, which was a Bond villain. Of course. So, but he played Loomis more often than he played Blofeld.
And he was in, isn't he the one that does the eating thing? He was in Dracula or whatever.
Yes.
He does the
Franklin Jella version, the 1979 Dracula that we covered. Yeah. Yes. And we learned that he is a prop actor because he knows that when he does things with food and props, they can't edit him out.
Yeah. So all his they can't food, edit around him.
Yeah, you're right. I had forgotten about that. I had totally forgotten about that. Yeah. It's an actor trick. Arthur O'Connell played Colonel Donald Reed. We know him. He's a very familiar character actor. You see him in a million things.
Oh, yeah.
He was in Picnic. He was in Anatomy of a Murder. And he was
in
chaplain.
Citizen Kane.
Well, yeah, he was in Citizen Kane. And he was the chaplain in the Poseidon Adventure.
Mm-hmm. And he's such a staple of 60s television and movies. Yeah.
William Renfield played Captain Bill Owens. He's the one that gets conked on the head by Donald Pleasance. He was the pilot, I guess you would say, of the submarine.
Mm-hmm.
Another very familiar face.
Really cool character, too, to give a character that's basically a cipher. He basically says, I can do that, I can't do that. This isn't working, this is working. Those are his lines. Mm-hmm. But he's so memorable in the role and very good. So
I've got that he was a good friend of Marlon Brando's. He was in the movie Death Wish. He played Harding in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. I don't know if you remember him. He's the one that was really disturbed.
Oh, yeah.
And then he died of leukemia at age 49. He died really young.
Oh.
So
okay.
He is no longer with us. Arthur Kennedy plays Dr. Duval. We know him from, probably his biggest movie was Lawrence of Arabia. But I know him from Let Sleeping Corpses Lie.
Okay.
Which is also something about the living dead at Manchester Morgue. It had a different title. Anyway, sorry. I've got a lot of horror trivia in my head. He achieved the role of Biff in Elia Kazan's historic production of Arthur Miller's Pulitzer Prize-winning play, Death of a Salesman.
Death of a Salesman. Yeah. Yes.
So that's what he's probably known for.
And tons of Westerns.
Mm-hmm.
So he was in every Western you can imagine, especially early 50s television. I mean, Westerns and then 60s television. So.
Well, and even though he's older and not as familiar to some of our listeners, maybe, he won one Best Actor and four Best Supporting Academy Award nominations between 1949 and 1959. That's
strong.
Five That's Oscars.
He was also, I think we covered it this season or last season, he was in The Sentinel. He was the Monsignor in the Sentinel.
Oh, actually, he won one actor and was nominated for four best sports. Okay, so he didn't win all of them, but he was nominated five times. Yeah.
Which is great.
Very impressive. That's what I have for cast. But speaking of Oscars, the awards section, this movie was nominated for five Oscars. Cinematography, art direction, editing, special effects, and sound. It won two. It won, as you mentioned, art direction and special effects. The Saturn Awards didn't start until 1972, but it was nominated for a Hugo for dramatic presentation, and it won a Motion Picture Sound Editors Award, which I completely get. That makes total sense to me.
Totally.
Yeah, but for something that doesn't make sense is it's not on the 1001 movies you must see before you die, and I think that's probably an error.
Oh God, yeah,
yeah,
definitely. I think especially of the science in the science fiction category alone, it should be in everybody's top 20 at least of ever, sort of thing. It's probably in my top 10. I could watch this over and over again.
My top 10 are Alien and Planet of the Apes, and you have not done reduxes of either one of those, mister.
Well, then it must be done. So let it be written. So let it be done. We must.
That's all I have, unless you want to do a little trivia before we move on to keys.
Tons of trivia. I've got tons of trivia from this movie. Just some production trivia again. So we talked about wet sets and dry sets. So all of these sets were dry. They were all on wire work. Again, why it took a little bit longer to film this movie, because they had to, A, research and develop all of these flying rigs. These flying rigs were developed by a gentleman named Foy, who went on to create an entire industry of it, who is still going on today. If you see flying sequences, especially in theatrical, like Broadway, wherever else, it's usually flying by Foy is the company that does it. But at this point, they weren't really concerned a lot about insurance and liability. So again, because we don't have computers, you can't show these wires, so they have to use the thinnest wires possible that can still hold these people up, but they also have to be able to conceal the wires as much as they can. So the way to do that was they would tip them in acid. They would tip the all of the cabling that go to the harnesses in acid, which would darken them so that they would, or lighten them up so they, on these white sets and everything else, you couldn't see them. However, it did...
It ate through them.
Eat away at the cables. And there were
I remember us talking about this.
What? There were some issues where people fell in these supposedly underwater rigs sort of thing.
Yeah.
So
I also love the scenes where people go flying. I forgot to mention that.
Oh, yeah.
The eardrum scene where,
I always remembered, even when I was a kid, when they were trying to get oxygen from, because their oxygen tanks are depleted, they have to get it from the lung, biggest oxygen provider. And they would say, what are all those brown flakes? And that's tar and nicotine from smoking in his lungs.
Yeah.
I remembered that.
I think it's the guy, it may be Grant in that one that goes flying.
And
I think Raquel Welch goes flying in the eardrum.
Yeah. Yes, both. Everything had to be practical, of course. So the set itself, this entire great big huge submarine they had, was actually put on a gimbal so they could actually move it and the actors could react to it moving side to side and everything else. Thought that was pretty cool. Mm-hmm. Trivia. Proteus, the name of the submarine is Proteus, named after the Greek god of the sea that could change his appearance at will to avoid capture. So almost like a cuttlefish or whatever, octopus sort of thing, but Proteus. This movie, a big trivia piece that a lot of people mention on this movie, and literally from the minute they enter the body till the very end when they're slowly growing and the credits are growing and everything else is 59 minutes. So it's literally an hour, just like their real miniaturization.
Okay, real time, yeah.
Yeah, almost in real time, which is really cool, and that would be very clever to edit and to film and to time and to try to do that in that thing. You mentioned one of the things that a lot of people mention with trivia for this movie is the antibodies. So the Raquel Welch character, yes, disturbs the eardrum and antibodies are sent to destroy the attacking pathogen, which is her. Excuse me. and they attach to her, start to compress to crush her, to, and she's taken aboard the ship, and all the other scientists and people try to help pull these off of her so that she can breathe. She's also in an award-winning, form-fitting scuba suit, which was very popular at the time. So two or three things about it. Everybody mentions in trivia and everything else that the scene where they are taking the antibodies off of her took three takes, because the first take, all of them were gentlemen, everything else, they tried to avoid any area that might be inappropriate for a young lady lying on her back with three men ripping stuff off of her. And Fleischer got upset and said, now she looks like a Vegas showgirl, like she's wearing an antibody bikini.
Yeah.
Sort of thing. So then he said, okay, so guys, let's shoot it again. Let's reset. Put them all back on her. All right, now let's do it again and do whatever. So immediately the gentleman decided, let's go for the other areas.
Yeah. So they all grabbed at her boobs pretty much.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that didn't work either. And Fleischer said, okay, now. So then he had to choreograph everybody's hand and what they picked when and where for all three of the guys. Meanwhile, another thing that's not in a lot of trivia is the prop department created the enzyme that they use for the antibodies out of like seaweed based enzymes and stuff so that they could be very gelatinous looking. And then they had other ones that were sugar coated for the crunching ones, when they, like you said, when they crystallized. But using both of those on the same set and the same day under all those lights was like, Raquel Welch has ended up saying it was totally disgusting, because they started, all the seafood started rotting. So it's like rotten, they had to layer on rotten seaweed on her several times, sort of thing. Let's see. I think that's all the trivia I have.
I only have one trivia, and it's that there have been several high-profile attempts to remake this movie over the years.
Yes.
And names that were attached are James Cameron, who's always doing underwater stuff, Roland Emmerich, Will Smith, Paul Greenglass, and most recently Guillermo del Toro.
But I would love to see his take on that, although I don't know how scientific it would be, but yeah.
Yeah. Actually, out of all of those, I think James Cameron would be the most logical.
Yes, yeah. Definitely. They built four different miniatures in various sizes for the Proteus for different shots, of course, especially that cool montage sequence when they keep miniaturizing them in stages, and like the little pronged kind of thing goes over and picks them up and carries them over and all that. Anyway, the smallest one was just about 4 inches. It was almost like the size of like two walnuts put together. And a crow flew into the special effects shop through a window and picked it up and stole it halfway through filming. And
so I think I remember reading that.
The miniature back. I thought that was a cool tribute.
Crazy.
Thing. I've got some watch note stuff. Like, I love lines in 60s and 50s movies like, this is the top brain man in the country. I thought that was a cool line.
Yeah.
And I've got, okay, so they can literally miniaturize humans and a submarine, but they use an overhead projector to tell the status of the mission. So, yeah. Willing suspension of technological belief. So
technological disbelief. Yeah.
Yeah.
Keys?
Well, you said the first one already. Isaac Asimov definitely is a key to this, and the novel that he wrote, novelization thereof. I mentioned Andromeda Strain, because I think this would be a great double feature with it, both with the whole thing of technology that we thought was supportive maybe going bad, and a time clock crunch and having to solve the puzzle, the scientific puzzle sort of thing. CMDF, the Combined Miniature Deterrent Forces, ended up having an animated series that lasted for a year. I don't know if you ever saw it, but it was really
cool. Was it called Fantastic Voyage?
Yeah.
I didn't know.
You need
that.
To look it up. It's really cool. Again, it's a key within a key because it's trying to be Johnny Quest. So it has like a young kid scientist whose dad invented the miniaturization process, so he's able to be miniaturized when they go on these missions and everything. So
I know, yeah. I never heard of it.
Yeah. Yeah. It lasted about a year, I think. This movie was used in medical schools up until the 80s. This movie was used to show complex venal systems and everything else. Yeah.
I've got the end credits reminded me of Night of the Living Dead because of the sound effects and the freeze.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a really good one. And also action is happening all during the credits. It's kind of like there's no denouement to this at all. We're doing it during the credit sequence. We got to end at 59 minutes or whatever. Yeah. So that's a good one.
The obvious ones, Incredible Shrinking Man, Incredible Shrinking Woman, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, and Inner Space in particular, because that's almost the same plot.
Definitely. Inner Space.
Which somebody's reduced and then injected into somebody. But, you know, we keep mentioning that before the music in the credits, there was the sound effects. And that's also very Forbidden Planet, wouldn't you say?
Very Forbidden Planet would be a good one for that. As a matter of fact, I think I read somewhere that they were inspired by the couple that did. The composer of this was inspired by the couple who did
Forbidden
Planet.
Yeah, because it was about 10
And those
years
went
later.
On to be seen in a lot of Irwin Allen. So Lost in Space, Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, all those, you can hear those sound effects. And you can see some of the panels because they also built that full. The set you see shown in this is literally the way the soundstage was written. It was built. It wasn't separate sound stages. So like the miniaturization room with the big control room that looks down on it. And then on the other side of the control room is the operating bay. And you got the body and everything else. So all three of those components were built as one huge giant set with a bunch of computer panels and spinning lights and all that kind of stuff. All those are repurposed by Irwin Allen. So.
Well, I was going to say, Irwin Allen's definitely a key, and Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea and Land of the Giants are both keys as well.
Definitely Land of the Giants. That's a good one. Yeah.
And then the only other thing I have are some that I caught from IMDb.
Yeah.
One is, for some reason, I have Soylent Green. I guess just because Richard Fleischer directed it as well. There's no real connection.
No, it was filmed. So the beginning, when Boyd's character is taken to the IMF or the CMDF, he's on a golf cart going underground. You're seeing all these. It's this huge complex, obviously. That was filmed at the LA Sports Arena, which is the same place they filmed Soylent Green.
A
lot of those scenes.
So it's a set key. All right.
And a trivia key thing about it is they could only film at night. So they would show up. They could only film during the day. So they would show up at like 6 a.m. or so, set up all of the sets and everything they need, the banners, the cast, the da-da-da. But they had to be cleared and completely empty by 4:30 or 5 because they had events there in the evenings.
Wow.
Sporting events. So for the 2 or 3 weeks they shot there, they had to rush in and rush out and guerrilla film it every day. So you got that.
And then there's another movie that I've never heard of that surely you have, called The Moving Finger.
Moving Finger? Yeah, I have heard of that. I don't think I've ever seen it, though.
Well, apparently the movie's plot was borrowed for The Moving Finger, which I don't know how it could be borrowed when The Moving Finger came out in 1965 prior to this. However, I don't know. Major Nelson works as a technical consultant for a studio making a movie in which an American astronaut shrunken to the size of a pinhead is injected into the bloodstream of a Soviet astronaut. Works his way to the brain, retrieves vital information to the defense of the country.
Huh. Well, there you go.
So I guess you can get in someone's head and know what they're thinking. That's weird.
You steal their thoughts.
Oh, here we go. The screenplay to this movie was completed in 1964 from an original story that was written in 1963. It just came out subsequent to the release of Fantastic Voyage. So it was written before then. So this... maybe a little bit of Hollywood espionage going on there. I don't know.
Interesting.
So The Moving Finger, folks, if you've ever heard of that. And that's really all I have as far as keys.
I think I've got one last one, which was Epcot. It's a Disney one, so you should like this. Epcot early ride was called Body Wars, was inspired by this movie.
Okay, that makes sense.
I never saw it, but that makes total
sense. I probably did and don't remember it.
Yeah. I mean, another scene I remember, too, that I just thought of was the heart scene. I love the suspense of that scene because they have to stop his heart for them to get through, which I thought was a really cool scene and very well filmed. I bought it and everything else, and the pressure, sound effects, everything. And the other one, of course, I think we mentioned it the last time, was the whole, we have to be quiet because they're near the inner ear.
Yeah.
And that the doctor is sweating and the nurse sees him and reaches back to grab the towel and pulls the scissors off or the forceps.
It's like a scalpel or something hits the ground. Yeah. And Raquel goes, fly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that.
This is just a fun movie. I think it's really great. I really think it's a good example of 60s science fiction. And like I said in the beginning, before even Star Trek and everything started taking over the mainstream, it was just, it's so good.
So good. I totally agree. And I think that's going to do it for today. And this little redux we've done, A Fantastic Voyage, directed by Richard Fleischer. David and I both like this film. We think that you would like it. If you have not seen it, you may want to give it a shot. Nothing like being reduced and put in a submarine and injected into a human body.
Of course. Everybody needs to do it at least once.
Oh, it sounds like we're going in another direction. That's going to do it for this week. For those of you out there that are listening, we would hope that you would leave us a review and or maybe make a comment down below. Let us know what you think of this movie or if it's inspired you to perhaps watch it. And for those of you that like what you've seen, we've got short shows on YouTube as well as some bonus content over on Patreon. We would love it if you'd come support us over there. There's free stuff as well as subscription-based content, including short shows that we do on television. We've done 4 seasons of The X-Files called X-Files Declassified, and we are now in production on the 3rd season of the original Star Trek, and we do those episode by episode. Hop on over to Patreon and help support us there. And until next week, David, when I think we're going to do a double feature in Horror Land.
Yeah.
It's a topic we haven't hit for a while. True. A good while, actually. So I'm looking forward to that.
It'd be fun. Yeah.
All right. I'll see you then.
See you then.
All right. Bye.
Bye.